This kind of retreat, this integrative retreat, is designed to let us bring open a field of inquiry that's completely welcoming of our whole selves, of our imaginative selves, of our emotional lives, of our dreams and stories, and to also then hold all of those in the spaciousness of meditation. So it's a kind of embodiment of form is emptiness, emptiness is form, in the way that we walk back and forth across the threshold of silence and companionship, of deep inquiry. And we do it with a work of the imagination that we becomes our focal point. For this particular retreat, what's been coming very much to the forefront in my mind as we've walked towards it is a connection between the ancient Buddhist image of lotus in the flames, lotus in the fire, and an old Norse folktale. One thing that I think I will be exploring together, and all kinds of connections I hope are going to be happening for in and through us, and one thing that I was noticing about that image of the lotus in the fire is that it often is sort of seen as, okay, you are supposed to be a lotus blooming in the middle of everything. And I would sort of like us to dump that idea for this and let, it may be there for you anyway, but what if the lotus, delicate as it is, moist as it is, blooming right within the flames, is something about just the way it is, rather than the way you are supposed to be. And so I was thinking about the way that we come to koans as something that we completely embody, and that we are willing to play at embodying. So I guess my sense of it is, if we hold that image in a way, in a bodily way, while we meet this story, what might happen? And I'm just curious about that, because our time is, this is such a time, you know? This is a time that hasn't happened before. And we humans are becoming someone that we haven't been before, because we haven't been here before. And so just by virtue of where we are in this world, in this time, together, we are already becoming a kind of being that hasn't really happened before. So what about that? So I would encourage you to journal as you like. Please invite dreams in the night, and we'll collect any that come in the morning. And put another log on the fire if you want. It's going so nicely. And to wander and take some ease, because ease is hard to come by in a lot of our lives. So that's my wish for us for this weekend. So I'm going to tell the story, and then we will have some time to just let it sink in, and you'll take it home with you, and we'll come back together with it and whatever else has joined us in the morning. So any questions for me about process or any of this? Questions, observations, objections? Okay. That's a quizzical look. Somebody? Yeah.
Okay, I'll say it.
Okay.
You're saying like this is a time where we're creating something that's never been created. Are you talking about us here together or?
Here together.
As a whole.
And as a whole. And as individuals inside of ourselves. Yeah. So often we think of our meditation as a shedding, you know, which it really is, as a subtractive kind of process. And this is one of the interesting things about an integrative retreat, is that we are doing that. We are letting ourselves release everything in our meditation. And in that space, there's something enormously creative that happens. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Anything? Okay, so here's our wild story from the Northlands. Once upon a time, long ago and far away, lived a king and a queen in their marvelous kingdom, happy, content in most ways, except for the secret sorrow that weighed upon their hearts. They were unable to conceive a child. This sorrow deepened and deepened in them, until one day the queen went wandering way into the forest where she could grieve alone, wailing and scratching herself and nearly lost. But there, in the depths of the forest, she came upon a strange old woman who said, "Why are you grieving? What is this melancholic thing in your heart? You need to speak it. I'm sure I can help." So the queen told her of her trouble, and the old woman said, "No problem at all. Here's what you do, but you must do it exactly as I say. You must speak your desire into a two-eared drinking cup. And tonight at sunset, in the northwest corner of the garden, put it bottom upwards on the dark soil. Tomorrow morning at sunrise, lift it up, and you'll find two roses, one red, one white. You must choose one of these, and only one, and you will conceive a child." The queen was filled with hope at these words, gave her most heartfelt thanks, and she did exactly as the woman said. But when she tasted the white rose, it was so utterly delicious. And the feeling of light entering her womb was so enthralling that before remembering, she gulped down the red one as well. Nine months later, her time came. The birthing room was prepared. The women were in attendance, and the midwife came, and she labored and pushed. But what the midwife first saw coming from between her legs was a small black snake, a lindworm. In horror, she tossed it out the window into the forest and turned back to the queen, who was now pushing out a gorgeous, perfect baby boy. The midwife never mentioned that other birth, and the king and queen happily raised their son, the bright, healthy son they had dreamed of, who grew to be a handsome prince, and suddenly it seemed he was 20 years old, and it was time for him to find a bride. So he saddled up and headed off to go out of their kingdom to find a bride in foreign lands. But he didn't get very far. Riding through the forest, he came to a crossroad that was totally blocked by a huge, fierce black snake, who snarled at him with wide open mouth, "Older brothers marry first. No bride for thee till there's a bride for me." The prince backed off, headed out by another route. Same thing. At the first crossroad, the huge black snake, "Older brothers marry first." Eventually, the prince had to return to the castle and report on these strange and awful events and ask his parents, "Is there something you've forgotten to tell me?" Deeply puzzled, they finally called for the midwife, who confessed what had happened, the small snake she had tossed away. The king and queen, frightened and amazed as they were, nonetheless rose to the occasion. "Go and find the lindworm," they ordered, "and bring him home. We must find him a wife." And this they set out to do. The king found a princess from a faraway kingdom who was brought to the castle and prepared for a wedding, only to find when she saw the lindworm that it was too late to escape. She was led to the marriage chamber, and that was the last that was seen of her. In the morning, when attendants opened the door, there was a pile of bones on the floor and the lindworm looking very well fed. This awful scene was repeated two more times. And after that, there was no king who would send a daughter at all. So the king went to a shepherd nearby in his own kingdom, first trying to persuade this father to offer his daughter, and when that failed, simply announcing that she was required to go. The daughter, terrified though she was, agreed. But after the king left, she went tearing off into the forest, where she was very much at home, in utter despair, shredding her arms and legs on the brambles as she ran. And deep in the forest, under a great oak tree, a little, very old woman appeared out of the tree and asked, "What is your trouble? Tell me, and maybe I can put things right." "I very much doubt that," said the young woman, but she told the whole story. "I'm going to be devoured by this beast. Shouldn't I be in despair?" But the old woman said, "Not at all. This won't be any problem. if you do exactly as I tell you. Before you go to be married, you must set these requirements. You must be given 10 white silken shifts, a tub full of lye, washing water made from wood ashes, some very strong brushes, and a tub of fresh milk. These must be ready in your bedchamber. Then, when the lindworm tells you to shed a shift, you must tell him he must first slough a scaly skin. And when all his skins are off, you must scrub him with the lye and then wash him with the fresh milk. And then you must take him and hold him in your arms, if it's only for one moment. Do just as I have said, and all will go well. And she disappeared back into the great oak tree. Awful as this thought was to the shepherd's daughter, she was wise and courageous, and she also saw that this was her best hope of surviving. So she did exactly as she'd been told. When the wedding day arrived, the bride was fetched in the royal chariot with 6 white horses and taken to the castle to be decked as a bride. Her requirements had been honored, even though everyone thought they were nonsense and that she would just be eaten like the others. She was led to the wedding hall, and when she saw the lindworm, she was indeed horrified. But he stood by her side, and she stood tall, and they were married. A great feast was held, and when it was over, the bride and bridegroom were led to their apartment with music and torches, quite a procession. As soon as the door was shut, the lindworm turned to his bride and demanded, "Fair maiden, shed a shift." The shepherd's daughter answered him, "Prince Lindworm, slough a skin." There was a long silence. Then, "No one has ever asked me to do that," he said. "But I command you to do it now," she replied. He began to moan, to writhe, to struggle and scream until an entire scaly skin lay on the floor. The shepherd's daughter removed a shift and laid it on the skin. Right away, the lindworm repeated, "Fair maiden, shed your shift." And she replied, "Prince Lindworm, slough a skin." And he did, with agony and a great deal of noise. And this went on until 9 skins lay on the floor, covered by 9 white shifts. And what remained of the lindworm was a huge, thick, gooey white mass, awful to behold. But the young woman knew what to do. She scrubbed and scrubbed with the lye as he writhed in agony until at last here was a man with a man's face, a face that had known long suffering, an ordinary man's face. She lifted his body into the milk bath and washed it, and then, utterly exhausted and still somewhat afraid, she lifted it onto the bed. She had one more step to take, to hold him, if only for a moment. In the morning, the attendants cautiously cracked open the door, dreading to see what they had seen each time before. But instead, what they saw was a man and a woman sleeping together in radiant contentment. That's our story. I came across this story actually in a book, The Wild Edge of Sorrow, that's about grieving. And then I have come across some other some connections that people have made in other ways as well. And as I've traveled with it some, I have found it. Resonating in a number of different kind of fields. You know, as an internal journey, certainly, and as a human journey. There was a quote I thought I would read to you. I just want to really briefly touch some themes that I felt arising, or that you might, that I'm curious about, and you might be too. Although it'll go its own way with you. But one question was about what can you trust? If that felt like a kind of a theme that was kind of woven through this story. And another was, how do we make a life? And the rhythm of that we speak of often in our way of enlightenment and endarkenment. Elements within ourselves, our own old stories. Sometimes we talk about turning the karma of our ancestors. I wondered about that in this story as well. And of course, masculine and feminine, fate and freedom. Each of us will enter it differently, and this time is for you. You know, whatever happens for you with this is yours. And in the sharing of them, just as in the sharing of a koan, it all gets bigger. So one connection that's related to that I wanted to bring in was with some paintings some of you have seen, but not all of you, by a Japanese artist, Iwasaki, who paints the Heart Sutra in from the tiniest microscopic level to the hugest cosmic level, writing the characters of the Heart Sutra into falling water, and also into the double helix, the DNA that guides life in so many ways. And it occurred to me that that compelling nuance, that the way that the code of our life sung in the scripture is embedded in every living cell uniquely. And there's something about that, which what will be expressed, you know, it just has to be discovered. And so how, I was thinking about the sort of code of enlightenment. How do we activate the code of enlightenment? And this story seemed to me to touch that. How do we activate the code of enlightenment that is at the very core of our being? So we have a good amount of time to sit and so I think what I'd like to do is, if everybody, since you've been sitting unscrunched, would you be good for sitting for 20 minutes or so? And then maybe we'll even have a little walk. And then there will be time to just bring in a word or two of what is coming up for you before we close for the evening.